moderator actually just stepped out.
No.
Oh, you're right there. Okay. And the moderator for the session is Tony Kirahara.
Kind of going to mix it up. It's at the end of the day, you know, I don't want to do the usual thing. We're going to make this much more interactive. My name is Naomi Hirahara. I'm known as a mystery writer. I'm going to be coming out with a middle grade book, but I was also served as the English editor of the Rafu Shimpo newspaper, which is a Japanese American daily in Los Angeles. And I guess my connection to this panel is twofold, or maybe threefold. I've done some work for the Japanese Community Health Incorporated in Los Angeles and interviewed some of their doctors. And while I was a reporter at the newspaper, one of my beats when I was very young, in my 20s, was to cover the closure of City View Hospital, which is also known as like the Japanese hospital in Los Angeles. And at that time, it was like a huge deal, and it really, there was so much strong reaction from doctors, from administrators, and the public. And it really made me aware at a young age how important this whole issue of healthcare is. I'm really excited to be part of this panel today because in terms of my generation, we're known as the sandwich generation. We're taking care of our children as well as taking care of our elderly. And of course, at the center of many of that is healthcare issues. So here we'll be bridging both the past and the present in terms of healthcare. And we have two eminent experts to kind of lead us on this journey. The first one, and I'm so happy to introduce her because she is also a personal friend, is Dr. Gwen Jensen. And as most, if you're of Japanese descent, you probably heard of this word chanto. And chanto means just being exactly right, doing things just the appropriate way. And that totally characterizes Dr. Gwen Jensen. I worked with her on a project of doing oral histories called Silent Scars for Healing Hands. We did that. It received civil liberties funding. And it was through the Japanese American Medical Association in Los Angeles, where Gwen actually had done oral histories with surviving physicians who had served at one of the 10 detention camps. And really, I mean, some of these individuals had been interviewed time and time again, but Gwen was able to perforate that surface and really get stories that we had never heard before. My role in that was kind of making that into this narrative for the book. Gwen was educated. She's very interesting because she has her bachelor's degree in geology from UCLA, but she went on later to get her PhD in anthropology from the University of Colorado at Boulder. And she has her own, and her dissertation is exactly on this topic about those Japanese Americans who were in camp and the problems they dealt with in terms of the hospital and healthcare. So you're going to be listening to one of the foremost experts in this area. The other person I want to introduce to you is Dr. Ken Bababono, and he's this is my really great vocabulary. I know he's a big shot. And I know he's a big shot because we were trying to nail him down and he had been in New York. He just traveled for the day today and then he's going back to California and going back to New York. And his official bio is he's the director of program design for Pfizer Health Solutions and responsible for program development, implementation, and evaluation targeting Medicare, pharmacy benefit managers, and health plans. He has developed programs to address medication adherence, wellness and health promotion, health disparities, and disease management models for the CMS Medicare Health Support and Senior Risk Reduction Demonstration programs. He recently completed serving on the State of California Diabetes Prevention and Management Work Group, responsible for providing recommendations for the Governor's Health Reform Initiative. He's also a UCLA grad. He got his BA there in biology and his Doctor of Pharmacy from the University of Southern California, So depending on where you stand, he went to the dark side. And the Master of Public Health from the University of California, UCLA. So depending on when you stand, he went on the good side. Prior to working to Pfizer Health Solutions, he was employed at an academic medical center and responsible for development of clinical pharmacy programs. Now, I noticed that on some of your name tags, it said MD and PhD, so you're really smart. I'm not so smart. So I just wanted Ken to elaborate in layperson's term exactly what he does as director of program design. And then after that, we'll go on with our program.
Thank you. Unfortunately, I'm not an expert, and I'm not a big shot at Pfizer. But my background is really, I'm actually a pharmacist, so my PharmD is actually Doctor Pharmacy, and MPH means that I have a master's in public health. In my role at Pfizer Health Solutions, I'm primarily responsible for developing health programs, and it really does address different types of health care issues today. And one of the biggest issues that we see today is really looking at the increasing cost of healthcare. And so a lot of the programs that we develop are trying to direct the lowering healthcare costs, but at the same time, delivering quality of care and improving access to care for people here in the United States. And this has significant impact on the Japanese American population.
Today's format, we're going to have a 10-minute presentation by Gwen, and then follow that, I'm going to ask I'm going to ask Ken to make a comment on her presentation, and maybe we might field one or two questions at that time. Then Ken will give a 10-minute presentation, and Gwen will make a comment, and then and at that point, we'll just open it up to a whole discussion. We could talk about healthcare in the camps, healthcare today, and how is it linked. And we really want you to become involved. If you have a personal anecdote you want to share that involved yourself or maybe your parents or grandparents, if you yourself have done research, we would love to hear from you. So, Gwen, please.
Okay. Well, thank you, Naomi. Delighted to be here at such a great conference, and in my allotted time, I'm going to talk about three aspects of health in the World War II camps. And number one, I'm going to talk about what the major problems were in camp, and then two, look at the long-term health consequences of time in camp, and then end up with what aspect of incarceration most affected health. And the short answer, if I don't get down to that, it was traumatic stress. Uprooting 110,000 people and putting them into the 16 assembly centers, and then again uprooting again and putting people on buses and trains to unknown destinations, and shades drawn in towns and cities. It was a terrifying experience, and it was very stressful. So all of this All of this was surrounded by stress at every aspect, and I think that's going to end up working into Ken's talk on long-term and present-day health concerns. So first, what did people encounter when they first went to camp? And some of you I know will know more than I, and I'd be happy to hear some of your experiences and if you can join us. But the things I found, I interviewed about 90 people, and I did some research at the National Archives for several weeks, and this is how I came up with all the information. The public health concerns were mainly the basics of food and water, the basics. And the second concern was the physical environment. And the third concern involved the systemic conditions, organization and planning of the camps, the lack of supplies and the lack of personnel to run the hospitals, and what was the actual government intent of what healthcare should be in the camps. So for public health, taking 110,000 people and crowding them into barracks and having them live in communal facilities, there was always the threat of communicable disease. And so on the first announcement that incarceration was impending, Japanese American doctors took it upon themselves to vaccinate people in their local communities, vaccinated against typhoid, paratyphoid, and smallpox. This process continued in the assembly centers, and then it again continued in the permanent detention camps. So very few people were missed, and only two cases of typhoid were reported. So the vaccination program overall was a success. But the single largest threat to health was the unsanitary supplies of water and unsanitary food handling practices. In an interview with Dr. Pamela Iwasaki, Dr. Yoshi Togasaki, who was a public health specialist, complained about the water conditions at Manzanar. It was running freely, they had no protection, and she complained that this was not adequate protection for the people. The administration said, well, we're sorry, that's it. This is the way it's going to have to be. So what she did was go around and ask everybody to collect samples of water where they found something unusual. And she brought these bottles to the administration and asked them, how are you going to get rid of this stuff? And eventually, they put in a filtering system and a chemical treatment systems that made the water palatable and safe. And this was brought to then all the other camps because they hadn't made provisions. Heart Mountain, for example, had based their water supply on reclaimed pipes from the oil fields. So not only was there gassy emissions from the pipes and it was smelly and oily residue, it was also contaminated with bacteria. At that place, they continually flushed the whole system with chlorine over and over and were able to finally clean up the water system. But it did leave a strong aftertaste of chlorine, of course. At Jerome and Rower, problems with the water supply were prevalent, and it was the same water supply that the nearby towns had, and they had no problems with it. So it took a while for them to figure out what the problem was, but then they eventually were able to fix the problem. But in the meantime, the kitchens had to boil all the water for all the people that were living there until it became safe. The water problems eventually were cleared up pretty much, but the food handling problems kind of persisted from throughout the life of the camps. Initially, people who worked in the kitchens didn't have any experience or training. So, you know, at most they had cooked for their own families or maybe a small cafe, but nothing in the large numbers of people that they were trying to feed. So bouts of dysentery and food poisoning occurred at all the camps and assembly centers. And from personal accounts and the WRA records, it was a continuing problem throughout the entire life of the camps. At Arkansas, dysentery was so common at one camp, it was called Jerome disease. And Dr. Mariota, who was at Manzanar, she worked in the hospital at Manzanar, reported that the hospital staff would say every once in a while, well, the twins are visiting again, meaning that the twins of Daya and Rhea were coming again. The diet was also a problem for diabetics because they didn't have balanced diets. Sometimes there would be five starches on a plate, and that is just the worst possible diet for someone with diabetes, as Ken is going to get into later on. The communicable disease, there was vaccinations against smallpox and typhoid, but there were problems from the mundane. There, you know, because of the communal baths, there were epidemics now and again of athlete's foot, but there were more serious problems with tuberculosis. And tuberculosis was the third largest cause of death, of adult deaths in the camps. And initially, few of the hospitals had the supplies they needed. They were requested, they were asked for, but they didn't come. And it took a while for them to even get the basics to care for people with TB. In addition, there was kind of a stigma against tuberculosis, so it was difficult to get people to work with the patients. And the way the doctors in the camps got around it was by training the patient's family to take care of them, and that helped a lot. But they were still having problems in the hospital cases. And as you know, another theme of the camps was the environment. Everybody talks about the dust. And when they first built the camps, they completely scraped off all the vegetation and left nothing in place to hold down the dirt. And so dust was a major problem, except for Roer and Jerome, which was built on swamplands. And there they were at risk for, people were at risk for malaria because it was endemic in the area at the time. But a combination of draining the swamps and then a spraying program pretty much contained that problem, so that there were only 14 cases of malaria total during the time. Another environmental problem was the extreme heat in the summertime, up to, you know, over 110 at Poston particularly, and Gila River. And that was a major, major problem for newborns in the hospital. One of my interviewees talked about the guilt she felt. She had delivered her baby, but the women on either side of her had lost their babies because of the high temperatures in the camps that was causing problems. But dust was the main problem throughout the area, and dust was especially bad the first year. People at Poston, which was three camps, would nicknamed them Roast'em, Toast'em, and Dust'em, mainly because, you know, that were the three experiences. And they noticed after in one spot that there was one block that had a low spot, and it filled in with water at a rain, and that kind of absorbed the dust. So pretty soon everybody else and all the other blocks had these little depressions they carved out to help them contain it, because eventually the farms were made and people planted around the barracks, and that helped with the dust problem. But dust was just the main problem for respiratory problems. It exacerbated pre-existing lung problems. It caused some asthma in previously unaffected people, and so much so that a lot of people were transferred to Amachi because Colorado's climate is supposed to be good for people with lung problems. But even Amachi had dust storms three or four times a year, and so it wasn't the ideal location either. Two particular camps had the worst problem, and one was Manzanar. Manzanar, because of the drying of Owens Lake and in Owens Valley, left toxic minerals in the dust available. And so when the storms came through, the dust particulates would get and be inhaled in the lungs, and they were toxic minerals that caused scarring of the lungs, they caused sinus problems, and may have caused some of the cancers that were reported from there. It is still a problem in the Owens Valley today, where people are having those problems, and they've just recently trying to fill up the lake to help control this dust problem. Gila River, though, was the worst on because it had coccidioides. It's a fungus that's very harmful to people. It causes what is commonly called as valley fever. And there's two forms of it. One's a very acute form that you can end up, you know, attack some part of your body and it'll go away. But there's another one that can be fatal. And some of it left disability, lifelong disability. And Naomi's book, An American Son, she did a book on George Aratani. And in there, she reports how he suffers from valley fever today, these problems. And so several people mentioned that they knew people who still were having problems. And one of the doctors we interviewed for the Silent Scars book, this one right here on the doctors, he had gotten his knees affected, but it did go away with time, so it wasn't so bad. The systemic problems were one of the worst too, because it affected the planning and organization. The camps were designed by the Army for young male recruits. They had no idea, they did not take into account women, they didn't take into account children, they didn't take into account the ill or disabled, they didn't take into account the elderly. None of this was prepared for. They expected young male people, and so there were problems right off the bat with that. The other thing that was problems with the doctors, the Nisei doctors who ran the hospitals, there was a white Caucasian doctor in charge, but it was the Nisei doctors who actually did everything in the hospitals. And so when they first came into camp, they found they were greeted with World War I vintage equipment. It was outdated, outmoded, and they found a lack of supplies and a lack of equipment. And they would request things and they would be delayed time and time again. So the doctors had to improvise. And Dr. Hara was at Tule Lake, and he mentioned how he had to create a pneumothorax machine, which is basically two tubes. That was the way they treated TB patients back in the 40s. And they had quite a few at Tule Lake. And within the first week that Dr. Kazue Togasaki was at Tanforan, a woman started to deliver. And so she immediately yelled for someone to take down the door off the latrine, and she used that as a delivery table because there was no delivery tables. And Dr. Hara had to create a delivery table himself at his assembly center, and he brought it with him to Tule Lake because they hadn't thought about pregnant women. He also tells the story of an older Issei man, and I'm see if I'm running over, right? An older Issei man who fell and broke his hip. And so they needed a drill to help repair this problem. And so they had no drill in the whole hospital. So they went to the carpentry barracks and asked them for a drill. They sterilized it and used it, and the surgery was a success, fortunately. I'll just go briefly and say that the Issei were forbidden from leadership positions. And so it was up to the Nisei who became the block managers, the administrators of the hospital. And one of the problems for healthcare was that all the talented midwives, the Issei midwives, were not able to participate in deliveries. And so all the deliveries then had to be done at the hospitals by the limited number of obstetricians. Susan Smith wrote on Japanese American midwives, so if you're interested in this talk, there's another book on that. There is one story that one tells me that about a recent graduate to illustrate the newness that everybody had to this. He took over the administration of the hospital at one of the camps, and he was in charge of all the supplies and making sure everything ran perfectly well. And he came running in, and he was waving this white towel-like thing over his head, and he says, "What is this for? Why do we need this at the hospital?" And so he was facing the nurses in the hospital, and they were going and laughing a little bit. And finally, to his chagrin, he found out that what he was waving over his head was a sanitary napkin. But people learned, and they adapted, and they persevered, and were able to make a working situation with time. Now, I'll just briefly mention that, and we'll lead into what Ken's going to talk about, is what I found with the long-term consequences of life in the camps. And after the interviewing and looking at my study participants and doing some national mortality statistics, I found that the legacy was that I found that there was 2.1 times more heart disease in Nisei who were incarcerated versus Nisei who were not incarcerated during the war years. And I had also looked at premature death because Donna Nagata, who had done a study on the Sansei, had found that Sansei fathers had died prematurely. And so I looked and found that indeed in this study that about Nisei fathers who, or Nisei men, I were 1.6 times more likely to die prematurely, that is before age 60, and compared to Niseis who were not incarcerated. And that correlates, there may be this legacy that goes with the Sansei, because there's Dr. Kenya Okamoto said that he goes back home, he's a Sansei, to California, and all of his contemporaries are dying before the age of 60. And so he wonders, what is the legacy for Sansei? So I'll stop here.
Thank you, Gwen. Ken, you want to say anything brief? And I know you're going to do a whole presentation, but...
I just had a question for you, Gwen. You know, obviously in the United States, the government has spent from 1900 to 1930, 1940, to eradicate all these diseases that you described. What was the government's response afterwards?
After the camps?
Did they go back and look at a lot of these people that had these diseases?
No. There was no follow-up with anybody on healthcare.
And then my other question really quickly is, you mentioned diabetes in the camp, and a lot of these patients probably had type 1 or insulin-requiring diabetes.
Mm-hmm.
Did they have insulin to be treated, or?
Sometimes they did. And one woman I talked to, her father went into a diabetic coma because they didn't have enough supplies of of the insulin, and he actually died. And so, I mean, there were cases where the lack of supplies endangered people
sure.
and caused death.
Let's take two comments or questions. Oh, in the back there first.
Oh.
You know.
Really?
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay.
And you guys are soft-spoken.
Can you hear me now?
You're not a loud-mouthed like I am, so. Yeah, talk right, yeah.
Can you hear?
Pretending you're kissing the microphone. Okay, yes.
Do you have any information about mental disorders as a result of stress?
I'll repeat the question. Any information about mental disorders in camp, Gwen?
I do. What I found just with the participants, and I had 60 participants, was basically it was more not clinical problems, but mild problems, such as some people reported traumatic flashbacks, and that was mainly in the Sansei or the very younger internees, the ones that were under 10 or something like that. Another thing, a lifelong problem that people mentioned was that there was a distrust of Caucasians when they got out. And sometimes this was not known. I mean, it would come upon them on realizing that this had occurred. And many people said that after redress, things got better for them, and this kind of dissipated a little bit. The third thing I found was that there was a deflection of personal loss. In other words, the Nisei would say, well, I didn't have it so bad. It was my parents that suffered. And that kind of goes with this balanced parallel of familial reciprocity, senpai sonke, respect for the elders, which the Nisei had, and then the Issei had for the sake of the children. Kodomo no tamini. I know I messed that up.
No, you did.
But this balance, and so by deflecting this loss, there was this denial of what really happened to the Nisei many times, and they didn't start feeling this until a lot of the commission hearings, and they started testifying, and then that really broke an ice, and I don't think I could have done the oral histories before redress, actually. I don't think I would have gotten the same responses. That's it.
Okay, I'm sorry, this gentleman in the tie. Not that I'm favoring the guy in the tie, but I think he, yes.
Real quick, on the deaths that are before, 60 years of age,
mm-hmm.
were the majority of those deaths caused by traumatic stress?
I have no idea.
Can you repeat the question?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, were the deaths that were caused before age 60, were they caused by traumatic death? And I don't know. There were a multitude of causes, and the sample was not a good sample. So
it's... You made a comment about that stress.
Yes.
So I wanted to know how that played.
It's mainly... it's about the only explanation by the time I went through everything of what could have caused the premature death or the heart disease, and among my study samples. And everything that I studied them on was the same between the Nisei who were incarcerated, like food, diet, exercise, all the normal parameters for heart disease were the same. There was no significant difference between the two groups. And so it's not a proven that traumatic stress caused it, but that is my supposition. That's what I think it caused it.
We're going to have more of a discussion after Ken presents his information, and then we can go back to World War II. But I want to make sure that Ken is able to share with you right now.
Okay. Thank you. I promised Naomi I would do this in 10 minutes. So I gave you a handout. So there's more information on the handout. What I'm going to talk to you about is what's really going on today. And I think you're going to see a connection from what happened, 60 years ago. And unfortunately, the conditions 60 years ago was not very good. I think what you're going to see today is still not very good. And this is going to happen continuing on in the future. Naomi asked me to describe my background. Well, what I wanted to show you on this slide is this is what we do. We develop programs to improve health and lower cost. But one of the key areas on this whole slide, and this is really what the healthcare delivery system looks like, is the fact that the government is where everything happens. This is where all the healthcare policy changes occur. But the people that are really influencing this are the community organizations like Japanese American National Museum, JCL. These are the people that are speaking for the community. But more importantly, if you look at the bottom, which is the patients and the families, this is where the level of control really does exist. And most people don't believe it. But as you start to look at the data, you'll see that this is where a lot of the decision-making is occurring. So today, I'm going to very quickly go through some of the factors influencing the healthcare of the Japanese American community, talk about some of the trends, and really talk about strategies of how we can improve a lot of the health that's going on today. And a lot of it does have connections back to what happened in the internment camp. One of the biggest changes is when this terminology Asian American came about. Before, it was the Japanese, it was the Chinese, it was the Filipinos. And what has happened with this terminology is that now everybody is grouped together as being Asian or Asian American. So you include people from India, you include people from Pakistan, Bangladesh, other Indian continents. And everybody knows that the Japanese culture is very different from someone in China or who's from China or other people from Korea. But as the government has come up with this terminology, everybody is grouped together. And this has significant impact on healthcare today. If you look at the population, and again, this goes back to even 1900, there are three main groups here, and everybody knows that the Chinese, the Filipinos, and the Japanese were the first to come to the U.S., primarily for labor. And until 1970, the Japanese were the primary Asian population here. But there was a big change in 1980 and continuing to 2000, to this decade, and that is that the Chinese, the Filipinos, and the Southeast Asians have now become the largest populations among the Asians. And if you look at in year 2000, you'll see that the Japanese Americans represent only about 800,000 people today, compared to almost 2.4 million of Chinese Americans. Well, what does this really mean? It means that when you take the census, you can say that you're Japanese, or if your parents were perhaps mixed, you can say, or your ancestors are mixed, you can say, I'm Japanese American and Caucasian, Japanese American and maybe Mexican American. And that's where the 1.7 combination comes from. But in general, the Japanese American right now are a minority population among all the Asian populations in the United States. And if you look at just the trends, you can see that people from India, which are Asians, they're increasing at almost double the rate of everybody else. This is like 113% growth rate, whereas if you look at the Japanese, we're actually just experiencing a decrease in our population. What this really means is that this has significant impact on this term called health disparities. And health disparities really means, in plain English, unequal care. And when you talk about social justice, health disparities really means social injustice as it relates to healthcare. And one way to look at this is just look at, you know, as Gwen talks about her oral history week, in which she can interview people, I go by what's published in the medical literature. And if you look at all the literature that's been published, and this is from 1960 on, when they started the databases, there's been about 700 studies on Japanese Americans. If you look at the other minorities, such as the Mexican Americans and the African Americans, it's anywhere from a 6 to 60-fold increase in information available about the population. And this creates a big void in trying to understand what's going on in our population. And that was my question to Gwen, because if no one's really studying what happened, nobody really knows what the impact is. And so I think, and again, this is just my own opinion, but I think that there's this void and people are now looking at other populations, because what drives health policy is looking at the size of a population and the growing trends. And you can just see that the Mexican Americans and the African Americans have been here much longer than we have, even though we've been here from the very, very beginning, and they have much larger populations to impact health, at least the healthcare research. So the trends, what's going on, is really key four areas, and Gwen touched upon diabetes, heart disease, mental health, and I'll touch upon these as well as cancer. What we have found in the data it's available, and trust me, there is not very much data. I thought this presentation would be really easy. I can just go in and get a lot of data. There is very little data on Japanese Americans today. The biggest studies are in diabetes, and this comes out of Seattle, Dr. Fujimoto and his group, which they looked at the Nisei men and Sansei men living in Seattle, and this was done in the early 1970s, and this still continues on today. But they found that the Japanese Americans or the Niseis had almost a 2 times higher prevalence of diabetes than Caucasians. And no one has really thought about this. Everybody thinks that diabetes is prevalent in the Hispanics, which they are, as well as the African Americans. These numbers actually show that the Nisei men have just have a higher prevalence of diabetes than these other populations. When you compare this to people in Japan, this is about a four to five times higher prevalence. So people in Japan, the numbers are roughly about 5%, 6%, and here in the U.S. is up to 20%. In terms of heart disease, again, you know, Gwen mentioned people in the internment camps had a 2 times higher prevalence of heart disease. This is some data from the Honolulu Heart Program. This is the longest study involving Japanese Americans. It actually started in the 1960s. And again, it was in Hawaii. And again, if you think about the population, the Japanese were the largest Asian population then. And the study is still going on, but it actually stopped in the 80s. It was a 20-year study. And what they found is that Japanese men had high prevalence of heart disease, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol. And if you look on the left-hand side, there's a whole syndrome called metabolic syndrome. And this says that if you have these type of risk factors, abdominal obesity, and I'm not saying you're obese, but you have basically love handles or a paunch around your stomach, it's a risk factor. If you have high cholesterol, if you have high blood pressure, or if you have high blood glucose, you are at increased risk for diabetes, heart disease, and stroke. And if you think about your relatives, your friends, especially that are Japanese, I would hedge that you would be able to find a majority of these people that have these risk factors. And if you think about it on a population level, if there were, say, 100 people in this room, 100 men, roughly about 20 people would have diabetes. And the number of people that are undiagnosed is roughly half of that, so you add on another 10, that's 30. And then if you look at the people that are at risk for diabetes, which is about 50%, you basically are looking at about maybe half of the people in the room that are probably going to have diabetes in the future and all the complications. And nobody is looking at this data, because there are no studies being developed except for these people up in Seattle and Hawaii. In terms of cancer, you know, and I sort of like broke it up between males and females. If you look at the cancer rates for the Japanese, who are in yellow, for the females, stomach cancer, colorectal cancer, and breast cancer are probably the highest or the second highest among all Asians here in the United States. If you look at the males, it's very similar: stomach, prostate cancer, and colorectal cancer. And this is in a period in which we have free access to healthcare. We have all the new technologies and the new therapies that are coming out, but yet our death rates are among the highest of all the populations of Asians. And the question about mental health, there is very little data, if any data at all, about mental health in the Japanese population. And I think Gwen alluded to it, post-traumatic stress disorder is probably fairly significant. Nobody knows what the number actually is. This terminology didn't come about until after the Vietnam War. And so when you go back to something that was probably fairly significant in the lives of the Japanese, there is no data to support what it is. And obviously, stress has been associated with heart disease. And so you can imagine that these people that went through camp, either our parents or our grandparents, had significant stress. And I would hedge that a lot of the things that Gwen just talked about is probably related to a lot of the stress issues. In terms of dementia, these numbers are very similar against the Caucasian population. But what happens is that the Japanese American population actually has one of the longest life expectancies, even in Japan. And as you start to age, and this data comes out of Honolulu, you'll see that as the older you get, your chances for dementia and Alzheimer's increases significantly. And this has significant impact on caregiving and end of life. Because in terms of caregiving, it used to be that the Niseis took care of the Iseis only because of respect for family, the fact that, you know, they all went through camp together and they were there to protect them. Well, the Niseis now, they don't want to be a burden to their children. And this is very well documented through a lot of studies and a lot of interviews. And so what's happening now is they're basically saying, you know, from the children, the Sanseis like ourselves, it's really to say, you know, don't worry about us. We'll, you know, things will be taken care of. So what the Sansei generation is now doing, because obviously they're working, they're busy, you know, they're starting to use a lot of these community-based services. And with few exceptions, there are not very good Japanese-American community-based services. In Los Angeles, the Cato Nursing Home is really a prime example of how care could be given in a very dignified and a very cultural approach, as well as in Seattle. The Cato Home up there is one of the early adopters of using these types of services. And in terms of end of life, again, the Niseis, you know, they don't want to be a burden. And so a lot of times they accept dying. And what they now do, and this is something that's very, very important for everybody, and that is to have advanced directives. You want to make your wishes known so that you're not put into a situation in which, you know, you're hooked up to a machine or and your wishes aren't known, especially for the children who have to make that decision for you. This is just some data from California. I'll just quickly go through it. This is actually in the handout in the very, very, in the very back. But you can just see that compared to other Asian Americans, and this is in California, and this is probably the largest set of data that's available, Japanese Americans do really well in physical activity at 30%. Unfortunately, the national standard is 80%. So even though we're the best among Asians, we're far below what the national standard is for getting physical activity. Feelings of sadness, which is really a proxy for depression, we are actually the best among all the Asians in California, but 17% really is a significant number for the potential people that have depression. In terms of healthcare access, everybody, we do really well in getting preventive screening exams, except for like colorectal screening. And again, colorectal cancer is one of the leading causes of death, and only 34% of the people get recommended screening exams. And unfortunately, we're still not doing very well in obesity. We have the highest rates of being overweight and obesity in California. And this is one of the major drivers for diabetes, heart disease, and stroke, as I mentioned. Alcohol, which is another risk factor, the Japanese American females, they have the highest rate of drinking in California. And something that just, I still cannot believe this number, but the Japanese American women in California had the highest rate of smoking. And with all the data available about lung cancer, the impact of smoking on diabetes and heart disease, we still are above everybody else in California in this day and age. And again, chronic disease, we talked about a lot of these things. I'll talk about asthma, 15%. We have the highest rate of asthma in California. And I would hedge, and I would probably bet, that a lot of this is due to the impact of the camps and how it's passed on through generations. It doesn't sound great. But I think there's a lot of things we can do, and one of them really is, and I just say this as a very generic statement, is that you have to be able to think about now and in the future. Whether it's your own health, whether it's your kids' future, whether it's the health of the community, you have to really start to plan now, because the numbers that are coming out is that if anybody's close to retirement or thinking about retirement, or if you have retired and you're over the age of 65, you need at least $200,000 in the bank to pay for healthcare today, regardless of whether you have Medicare. Very few people have that kind of have resources in the bank to pay for your own healthcare. you should get an annual physical exam, you talk to a doctor, and you will be, should be able to adopt and address a lot of these things that you have control over. During the internment camps, nobody had choice. You have choices now to improve your own health and take control of it, as well as for your family. That is, be physically active. You have to exercise. You have to adopt a healthy diet. You have to lay off the high carbs. You have to eat fruits and vegetables. You have to lay off red meat. A lot of these reasons for health diseases today is because of the adoption of this Western lifestyle. It's very well proven that what goes on in Japan, it changed when all the Niseis and the Iseis came over, and that's what we're seeing today. And finally, obviously, you have to lose weight and maintain a healthy weight. And obviously, get preventive exams. They're not painful. A lot of them are just blood tests. It will tell you whether you're at risk for a lot of these issues. If you have family history, you're more likely to potentially be at risk for these. And finally, I just want to close and say, you know, it's kind of ironic, but, you know, we are Americans. This is our country. But when you look at the data, or I should say the lack of data about our population, it's kind of scary in the sense that what's going on, and the government is not going to help you. The government allows you to do a lot of things, but it's really up to you, your family, and the community to really stand up for your health care rights because, you know, for all the work that the Iseis and the Niseis did, this is all going down because when you start looking at the disease numbers are not going down, they're actually going up. And a lot of it's just a lot of things that could be under our control. So thank you.
Thank you, Quinn. Ken, Gwen, would you like to make any comments at this time on what? Okay. Okay, we really want this to be interactive. And if you have a long thing to say, please come up and speak directly into the microphone. If you have a quick question, just you could say it from your chair. But yes.
I have a lot of things to say.
Okay, please come up.
Hi, Naomi. Naomi and Gwen didn't pay me to be here. My name's Troy Kaji. I'm a family practice doc from Berkeley, and I really appreciate how well Naomi and Gwen did the narrative of that book there. I've been doing a few of these oral interviews with a lot of the doctors who passed away since, and they did a great job. They covered everything. I want to make a comment and then ask Gwen a question. One comment was, Naomi mentioned how her awareness of this started with the closure of the Japanese hospital or City View Hospital in 84, and that's kind of when my awareness started too. But the importance of that institution is that it went on to build these CADL nursing homes, which, you know, hooks into Ken's talk, which is why there are resources in Los Angeles. The other thing that you mentioned was, there's very few places where these studies came out of. Honolulu Heart Study was born out of that other Japanese hospital in Hawaii, which is now called Kuakini Hospital. And we lost our hospital. And so we don't have an organization in LA that's making research happen, but I guess the community could still pull this together somehow if that was a priority. Okay, now my question, which I don't expect you to answer. For Gwen and Naomi, I know you did all these oral interviews, and that's really important because those stories of the experience, that's the only way you could get those. I was wondering, in all your digging in the archives, if you've ever figured out how the doctors were assigned to where they were assigned. I've run across this name, G. Carlisle Thompson, in some office in San Francisco that seemed to move doctors around from camp to camp, especially if they weren't liked somewhere. Mm-hmm. I won't mention any names.
No.
So I'm just wondering if you found anything about that level of how the medical personnel was set up. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Troy. I did find that the doctors were basically assigned on their geographic area to start. And that was, if they lived in Sacramento, they went to Tule Lake. If they lived in Portland, they went to Minidoka. There would be a preponderance of doctors in LA. There were a preponderance of doctors in, San Francisco. So they moved people around where they needed them to try and balance it out. For example, the Togasaki family, there was Dr. Yoshi Togasaki, Dr. Kazue Togasaki, and Dr. Teru Togasaki. They ended up in three different camps. And Teru was at Poston, Kazue was at Tule Lake, and initially Yoshie was at Manzanar, and then later on she was transferred up to Tule Lake. So some of it was personality, in some cases where people weren't getting along, or in the Manzanar riot, they transferred a doctor because he wouldn't testify that the he operated on the people who had been attacked, and he would not say that they were shot in the back because he found they were shot. They were shot in the back. They were not shot forwards. They were not coming at the people. They were running away, but they still shot him. And the government didn't like that, so they moved him to
Topaz.
Topaz, right? Thanks. So that's. But I don't have any, systematic way of how did they decide who was going where, outside of the initial balance they tried for.
I wanted to make two comments. Just Troy Kaji, your grandfather, is that correct? Was the pioneering Issei doctor, and his name was
Tashiro,
Dr. Tashiro. So thanks for sharing for the, and Troy, I know, has done a lot of research in the Japanese hospital as well. And I wanted to also comment on what this is taking it from a different direction, but when we were looking at the doctors who had served in camp, one thing I found real interesting is there were so many women who are physicians, and that kind of broke my stereotype of the Nisei women. And I think because there were about quite a number, weren't there? There was
like six or so.
Six or seven.
Yeah.
And I think we came to the conclusion that it's hard to put a really you can't put a really intelligent woman down, or in other words, she was going to either rise to the top or many of these women did, and they're really incredible. And as, I don't know if you were aware, but of course in medical schools there were quotas, right, for maybe just one spot for a Japanese American to study medicine at for that class. So that was kind of interesting. I also wanted to comment on Gwen. If you're interested in reading more of Gwen's work, she does have something on the Discover Nikkei site, right?
And I have some papers.
And she also has papers that you could pick up. And a lot of the oral histories that she's done, and she's done over 80, are archived at either the Japanese American National Museum, the University of Colorado, is that correct? And at some other places. So you can, if you're really fascinated with this topic, you could follow up. Okay, yes, Iku.
I have two quick questions. Why don't you?
Go ahead, but I'd like to be next.
Okay.
Actually, it's just related to what I heard. I want to make sure my notes are correct, and it's what this one gentleman referred to. I'm not quite sure if I understand. It said that Nisei fathers died prematurely, 1.6 times more likely before 60, due to food, diet, and exercise. And then it said, or I have down here that this one doctor noticed that his sansei friends also were dying prematurely before 60. And I don't understand really the connection, because I can see where the Nisei fathers would have been influenced by the environmental factors, the poor diet and all that. And I'm not sure how that, I got the implication, or it sounded like it was genetically or somehow or other transferred, unless the sansei fathers were also afflicted as children in camp. I'm not sure if that. The second question is, when Dr. Babamoto mentioned that there are a lack of studies for JAs. Now, some of the forums that I've been doing over in LA, one doctor mentioned that the reason there isn't much on JAs is because they don't volunteer for studies. And so if you could maybe, because if you don't have JAs volunteering for studies, then he said then that means that you wouldn't have very many results. So if you could maybe address both of those.
Well, let me just clarify on the sansei, because Donna Nagata found that Nisei fathers had died prematurely. and she had no statistics, and so I looked into that and found the 1.6 times Nisei men had died prematurely before age 60 than those who hadn't been incarcerated. Now, the Sansei, that was really anecdotal. It's just an observation by Reverend Okamoto that he has observed, you know, from his class. He was born in Poston, and so he goes back to reunions in California and has found that a lot of his friends are dying prematurely. They're male friends mainly, but he would like to know. But there's no studies on the Sansei.
You were in camp with the Sansei.
Right, right. But that's not a study. That's just it's something that should be studied. And
well, I think Dr. Kaji can probably, you know, add to this, but the data that's available, not so much for Japanese, but in the general population, is that there is family history relationships. Is it genetic? It's hard to say, but most definitely, if your father or your parent died, especially your father died before the age of 55 or had a heart attack, you yourself are at significant risk for having heart disease. And so there is that component. Did the camp influence that? Potentially only because, you know, I think if you look at all the getting back to the whole stress issue, you know, stress is a factor, a corresponding factor. And so there's a lot of things going on. And I have never seen a long epidemiologic study except for like the Honolulu Heart Study, which, you know, it was almost like a 20-year study which they looked at people. But a lot of these people were not in camp. Maybe they were already in Hawaii. So it's hardly hard to say. To your second question about involvement in clinical studies, what happened, I think, is that in the 60s and in the 70s in Seattle as well as L.A. and Honolulu, I mean, the Japanese Americans actually had a very large population. In Hawaii, it was almost 8,000 people that had volunteered for the studies. Is that impacting now? I don't know. I think a lot of it has to do with funding. And to be honest with you, what we've seen, and I think a lot of researchers have seen, is that they're not interested in the Japanese Americans anymore. I think they are interested in the 60s and in the 70s, especially with the Honolulu Heart Study and all the data that came out. I think now they're really interested in the Southeast Asians. It's a new population, a whole new set of health issues coming in. And when I go to conferences, that's what everybody wants to talk about, is the Southeast Asians, and as well as the Chinese.
Thank you, Ken. And now, please.
I'd like to share with you a little bit about the geography thesis I did related to Heart Mountain, Topaz, Minnetonka, and also research of the forced relocation and the suffrage and the environmental stress that I've looked at about all those incarcerated and comparing to those who were in the different camps on the West Coast, Portland, Seattle, LA, San Francisco, all of those areas. It was amazing to see how the environment changed everything. You know, people who've never seen snow were in environments where snow happened, and temperature variations, you know, up and down, and those environmental climate and how that affected the stress as well. And now I put down, you know, you look at the map of all the camps and you see where they're located, and it's like, where are the hospitals? And so having them to go out of the camp, out of the area, in the center of nowhere, you know, and they would have to maybe walk and trek for miles. Who knows where they had to go, getting from the camp into an outside facility. Again, that's another trauma for being in a different place. So why wasn't there something built in the center of a camp to have those services? And so it's obvious that the WAR didn't set these things up, didn't trust the Japanese round the clock. And so in regards to all the disease, especially in Topaz, regarding influenza, there was about 300 people who suffered from that. Do you know of any cause? What happened with the influenza? Could you elaborate on that?
Well, Topaz had some epidemics of influenza, but I don't have a cause for it. No, I don't. I do have to say that each camp had a hospital in the camp, and it was, they had a white administrator, and then...
Inside or outside?
Inside, each one. And it they had Japanese-American doctors and some Issei doctors also were there. If there were a critical case where they didn't have the facilities, they tried to take care of it in the camp hospital. But, for example, Heart Mountain, they had transferred you to Cody. Tule Lake, they were transferred to Klamath Falls. I know of one person who had a mental breakdown in Manzanar, and she was sent to a hospital in Salt Lake City. So they did transfer, but a limited number of people. And there were a lot of people that got no we'll just wait and see, and were postponed. And in particular, one doctor that worked in Sacramento, he was first sent to Tule Lake. He knew his mother was sick. He worked in the hospital. He wanted her to get an x-ray at Klamath Falls because they had no x-ray equipment initially in some of the camps. Well, all of the camps, but they were gradually getting them. The administrator, the white doctor in charge, said, no, you'll just have to wait. Well, they were finally transferred to Topaz, where he watched her just die of cancer. And it's not that she might not have died otherwise, but they refused to transfer her to this hospital because they were trying to keep everything inside the camps. And so a lot of people with problems, like the diabetic I mentioned earlier, were not transferred when they should have been. And for example, you're right about the Arizona camps. There were no outside facilities to ship emergency people really close by. I mean, well, for example, Manzanar cleared to Salt Lake City for the mental health issue. There was one case where he was sent back, a person with cancer had been sent to LA to be treated under armed guard, but it was just not routine. They had tried to take care of it all in camp. Did that answer?
Yes, thank you.
I just had a follow-up question about the geography, because I didn't know if you were asking why the hospital within camp was more centrally located or not. I'm not sure. Do you know, Gwen, in terms of all the camps, were the hospitals kind of located in different locations? Were they central within the camp?
It was actually outside the camp, wasn't it?
No. It was in camp.
Yeah.
But it was usually on the perimeter.
I was looking at the map of Heart Mountain, and it shows the hospital being just outside the main gates. I mean, I've seen that on the map somewhere.
Go ahead.
In Manzanar, the hospital was in the last block 36, and I know because my mother was constantly sick, so originally we were in 23, and then because she was ill all the time, then we were moved to Barron 36.
Closer.
And so it was farthest away.
Well, you know, the camps were on a 640-acre pad, basically. And so all the blocks, there were up to 10 or 12 blocks in each camp. There were a lot of people separated. And so generally, from what I've seen of the different hospitals, they were located right on the perimeter. As you go into the gate, usually the hospital was right next to the administration buildings. Now, I can't say for sure, having looked at Heart Mountain, but I've seen it on the land, and if it was just inside the gate, it was right there. It was part of the whole complex. It was not separated physically by more than several miles from, you know, people. They did have ambulances, so, you know, critical cases could be taken by ambulance from one end to the other, but...
Yes.
Pardon?
It's a large camp, 1, 2, and 3. And we just drove by there. It's very long. So if they had one hospital, that's a lot of trekking, and a lot of attorneys had to walk to the hospital.
That's right. It was a long distance.
Wasn't like next to a hospital.
No, but it was in the camp,
yes.
Generally. And Houston is one of the worst ones because it was three.
They have three hospitals or one that's very
As far as I know, you had one, and
you have to Newby is talking about that.
And in fact, in some of the records they talk about, they didn't have enough ambulances to treat the population because they were having trouble getting people. They would have to use trucks and whatever to help. And emergencies were a major problem for getting somebody if they lived on, like your mom, one end of the camp closest to the hospital. So
there was a gentleman here. Yes.
My name is Frank Nakano. I'm a physician. I have been in practice in Los Angeles, west side of Los Angeles, Culver City, for 38 years. And I'd like to give a little bit, I want to commend the panel, of course, but I want to give a little different slant on some of the comments that were made. First of all, the statistics as far as the ethnic studies and the breakdown, I think part of the problem is that it isn't a problem for us, Jays. The multitude or the volume of literature on, say, the blacks, the American blacks, is because they have a higher incidence of hypertension, diabetes, heart disease, out of proportion to the rest of the community. And then the Mexican American population, a little bit less, so there's a lot written about that. In regards to us, again, as far as heart disease and malignancy of the GI tract, particularly stomach, the landmark studies that you alluded to, or somebody did here, about the heart studies of Hawaii, I was almost involved with that, but I became an observer of that. Started out with gastric cancer, very high in Japan. They studied comparable groups in Hawaii and then in California, or west coast. And as you came east, Hawaii had a lesser incidence of gastric cancer, and the west coast, Nisei's had the least of the three. Going to cardiovascular disease, actually it was heart disease, it was the opposite. Less in Japan, higher in Hawaii, higher in the west coast. So the implication is it's because of the American diet, which is probably true. The other comment, again, I'm a cardiologist and an internist. In 38 years, when I first started out in practice, City View was certainly active. And I believe, and this is my own opinion, that the reason that City View wasn't as needed as before, and in fact, after City View closed, the nucleus of the doctors moved to St. Vincent's Hospital, and they had a mini hospital there. And so the community was taken care of. But I believe that it was because of the language problem. Initially, when I first went in practice, the reason I stayed in that part of town was because of a lot of Issei's that did not handle the language well. And based on my personal experience with my parents, they were misdiagnosed for most of their lives because they couldn't speak English. There was no Japanese-speaking doctors. Over the 38 years, my Japanese has gotten worse because I have fewer Japanese-speaking only patients, which is, in a sense, good. And just a personal comment, again, or observation, as far as the general health of the Japanese Americans, at least in my community, it's gotten better. When I first started, and I trained at UCLA in cardiology, we had only a treadmill available in the hospital for research purposes. About the late 70s, mid to late 70s, we were able to obtain treadmill tests for our own offices. So in that era, in the 70s, I would not think of putting an 80-year-old Nisei or Issei on a treadmill because it was too dangerous. Now, 38 years later, I put 90-year-olds on a treadmill. And I think this is a reflection of the general health of our community. And I think it's optimistic. I got the feeling sitting there that, boy, what you're saying, and you go by statistics, of course, statistics are helpful, but they don't always tell the true story. But I was feeling if I had no more information, I would be, you know, I'd be very fearful about the fate of the health of our community. But I think actually it's quite good.
Oh, thank you. And my point for using those numbers is that there, if you look at a lot of the studies that are done, and I totally agree with you about what goes on in practice could be very different what you see in the literature, that the numbers, those are the numbers that people use, and even though it was from 20, almost 30 years ago, if you try to go in and actually look at what is the prevalence or incidence of diabetes among the Japanese Americans, nobody reports that. Even the CDC, the American Diabetes Association, they do it as Asians or Asian Americans. And it makes it difficult. And I think some of the numbers that people say, even though there was 20%, 17 to 20% out of Hawaii and Seattle, is that even today it's more like around 10 or 11, 12%. But nobody can say from a large number to say what it is. But what people are really beginning to say, though, is that the people that have or are at risk for like prediabetes and diabetes, that the stereotype of being obese, your typical picture, they don't fit that paradigm. They don't fit that picture, and so it's really being underdiagnosed today.
The recent publicity about diabetes is type 2 or the metabolic.
Yes.
Which is no longer genetic.
Right.
Whereas the diabetes in the Japanese American community is based on genetics from Japan, as high as it's here. Metabolic syndrome is certainly present in the Japanese American community. One of the prime characteristics to have that diagnosis is the men to have waist size of 45 plus, the women 35. A lot of the GAs in the my practice are not that big. I mean, there weren't a lot in my practice.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that's what the American Diabetes Association is really struggling over now, especially in the Southeast Asian population, the Vietnamese, is that they're basically thin, but their diabetes prevalence is pretty high right now, and that's why a lot of the research is looking at that.
I'd like to make one comment, too, on the study you mentioned that compared heart disease from Japan to Hawaii and then with San Francisco area. They saw an increasing amount of heart disease. And one of the problems I have with that study, it was a great study, it was well controlled, but the one question they didn't ask was whether or not any of the men that participated in that study were interned. So you couldn't tell if internment had made a difference in the rate of heart disease between the populations and what kind of, and they could have, because if somebody wanted to, they could get a hold of this database just sitting there and go back and find out which people were interned and do a really rigorous study on that.
That's a good point. The point of my question about mental disorders is that I believe the answer is that the Issei mentality or the cultural aspects of Issei probably had a lot to do with it. And in retrospect, I was only a kid in camp. And looking back, I'm positive that my father suffered from chronic depression as a result of the
right.
Also, in that same vein, however, he carried the cultural traits of lower incidence of heart disease in Japan within hearing. So, I don't know. The question would be how the stress affected Issei.
Right.
I have to cut. We're almost out of time. This woman, do you want to ask your question really well? Okay.
In your research, did you see any reference to the incidence of rapes in camp?
Not really. No, I didn't look at that much at all, so I don't have any. Right.
Did you say
right.
rape?
Rape.
Yeah.
Because I knew of one in Art Walk here.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I've read about them, but I didn't do any kind of really rigorous look at it statistically or how common it was or not. So, yeah.
I just want to comment.
Yes.
I think it's our food that's available. I mean, our parents and grandparents were eating really fresh, and you know, and the air was cleaner. So I'm blaming it on McDonald's and Burger King, and then all this processed food. There's so much weird chemicals. You don't even know what's in it when they label it. So I think with all this more unhealthy food that's available, we're, you know, eating that. It's easily available. So I think that's part of it. I think our grandparents and parents ate much better. And if we ate like them, we'd probably be better off. So we need to go back.
I think Ken would definitely agree with that. And the only point I'd make is that the people I looked at were both of the same age and had both grown up at the same era and had basically the same diet. So I was not comparing Sansei, for example, or different generations.
But look at the sodas.
But, you know,
they only had, like, a couple of flavors.
Right. But, you know, the ones that who were not interned had the same diet. You know, the ones that lived here in Colorado, the ones that lived in Nevada. That should have come out, that was a big difference in it.
Yeah.
If anything,
the Sansei's in the United States, that is going to be different. You need to look at the food.
Yeah, and the food was not good in camp. It definitely was not healthy in camp. So.
Well, I'm so happy that all of you have all these questions, and we had a great discussion, and I am almost sad to cut it short. But I think what Troy mentioned, what Ken mentioned, in terms of we need to have some kind of central networking involved so we could share information or, you know, advocate for certain kind of studies or services. I think that's imperative, and maybe you can afterwards talk to either one of these people and, you know, start networking in that area. So thank you so much for coming here today.
Thank you.
Good.
I didn't mean to.